And by the way.
Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, April 8th, 2008 Carborough Board of Aldermen work session. Before we begin, I have a couple of announcements. The first is that it's been pointed out to me that April 11th, which I believe is this coming Friday, is that the Friday, the 11th, is going to be the last day to register to vote before the May 6th primary. So if you are not registered to vote, you should register to vote by April 11th. You can get a registration form here at Carborough Town Hall. I believe we have some out in the hallway or at the DMV office, or contact the Board of Election, Orange County Board of Elections at 732-8181. And also, if you are 17 years old now but will be 18 years old by the time of the November election, you are eligible to register to vote in the primary. You do not have to be 18 to vote in the primary. You only have to be 18 by the time the general election happens. So perhaps some of our viewers can encourage their 17-year-olds to get registered to vote. All right. One other important announcement I want to point out is that science class of Alderman Randy Haven O'Donnell.
Oh, not my class.
Her team.
Science Olympiad team.
Her Science Olympiad team competed in the North Carolina State Science Olympiad Olympics competition this past weekend and finished fourth in the entire state of North Carolina.
Yay! It was awesome. Thank you.
No doubt, at least partly because they have a great team leader.
We had a lot of fun. It was great work.
Congratulations to you and your team. All right. With that, we'll begin our regular agenda, a work session on recommendations for the Northern Study Area Plan.
Okay. On February 12th, the board held a work session on a series of recommendations made by the Northern Study Area Plan Implementation Review Committee. On March 4th, the board adopted a resolution that specified next steps related to the recommendations and requested a work session to examine certain issues in greater detail. A resolution that provides an opportunity for the board to specify follow-up actions is provided, and we do have a staff presentation involving two staff folks. First is Trish McGuire, Planning Administrator, and then Lisa Buckley, who was a new staff member that I'll tell you a little bit more about when Lisa comes up to do her presentation. So, Trish.
Good evening, everyone, and as always, thanks for your time. So this is a... Thank you. We just have a hopefully it will not be too lengthy presentation for you. We'll try to be direct and concise, and what we do want to provide you with a couple of different kinds of information. First of all, some background information to put everybody on the same page as far as the process. And some of the information that the NSPIRC reviewed in terms of maps, both in their meetings and in community meetings. Some additional information that y'all have requested to see. A primer on form-based zoning, little instructions, an overview of that approach to regulations. And then just recapping the recommendations of the NSPIRC from December 11th. And we've provided a sort of a discussion template, hopefully to help with your discussion of these topics tonight. So in terms of the process, there were 17 folks ultimately appointed to work on the committee, the Northern Study Area Plan Implementation Review Committee, and they were charged with evaluating the implementation of the Northern Study Area Plan, the effectiveness of the efforts that had taken place to date. And a number of meetings were held, 20 meetings were held between March and December of last year. Two community forums were held to collect input from residents and business owners and so forth. The NSPIRC reviewed their own they brought to the table their own views of this area and assessment of the implementation of the plan, and received information from the community on those points. and looked at information about what had taken place in the Northern Study Area over this period of time. They prepared a value statement and then came up with a couple of different rezoning proposals and then a series of recommendations which were submitted for your review. So in terms of the context, this is really just a very brief summary of information that was looked at by the committee. This is the basic location map of the Northern Study Area. It's the area outlined in green are the boundaries of that area. So Estes Drive up our jurisdictional boundary to the north, again coming down to Union Grove Church Road, back along Dairyland to Calvander, and then down old NC86, Hillsborough and North Greensboro streets back to Estes Drive. This area encompasses about almost 4,000 acres of land, and at the time the plan was adopted in 1999, about 1,400 acres were in the city limits. Since then, rather, were in the town limits or in the ETJ. Since then, we have annexed additional land into the town limits, and so there are now 2,035 acres in those two categories of land, of jurisdiction. And at the time the plan was adopted again, there were 2,300 acres in transition areas. 1 and 2 are joint planning authority areas, and now there are about 1,700. In terms of population and growth, the plan expectations are shown on the left. So the plan took census data from 1960 and 1980. Current municipal population estimates from the State Demographer's Office, and then projected population through the year 2000 and 2010. And then our census data from 2000 showed us pretty close to the projected population from the plan, 16,782 versus 16,874, and then our current our most recent municipal population estimate again from the State Demographer is 18,016.11 from 2006. Based on current trends, the past really 6 or 7 years of population growth in the town. Our growth rate is actually a little bit lower than it has been in previous periods. And so looking at these numbers, we can see, if we stay on this current trend, a population of about 20,000 rather than 24,000 in 2010. And this is just a graph that you all have seen before, but just for everybody's kind of iteration, the certificate of occupancy side of this in terms of its relation to population growth. And so you can see at the very bottom, where we are in current years in terms of single family and multifamily certificates of occupancy compared to previous years. And we've seen, these numbers occurring at different times in the past, but we are seeing a slowing of the growth or the increase in residential units in town, new residential units in relation to these certificates of occupancy. This is just a basic contextual map that shows us over time in terms of housing units. So we're looking back at 1950, add a few in that next decade. Again, seeing our growth through the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, and then since 2000. And so that's essentially where we are. This is a snapshot we created as of 2007. So looking at housing units during that period of time and our current pattern of land use. These are numbers that come from the Land Records Office in terms of date of construction for residential units. This is just a map to show the committee looked at and the public did too, to see what our existing and proposed density is over these various residential neighborhoods in the Northern Study Area, with the darkest colors on the map showing the most densely developed areas. And we see those occurring. We have both projected for the Carolina Commons site, in terms of your proposed developments at Valentine and so forth. And then, of course, the projects that have been built or are under construction, like Hogan Farms, the Fox Meadows subdivision, Barrington Hills and so forth. So our highest locations are actually down here near Spring Valley, where we have in the 4 unit per acre range. We see those ranges 3 to 4 units up here at Winmore and also at Claremont. And Winmore has a little bit more density potential, but this is based on the actual total number, not the, the opportunity for additional garage units and so forth. The bulk of the area is developed, you know, more in the 1 to 2 unit, dwelling unit per acre range. So this is an illustration of the sort of development potential under existing zoning for the northern study area. All of the pink lots are lots that we call sparsely developed. So they're either undeveloped lots or developed lots that have additional room for units in terms of their land area in relation to zoning. And the numbers that are shown on the map in yellow show what kind of density, number of residential units, the sites could yield based on existing zoning, with you know, total estimate of available acreage just under 1,000 acres and number of units about 1,300, with an overall density for the area, you know, under 1.5 units per acre. And this is this map was presented in relation to, understanding that plan goal of an overall density for the northern study area of 2.1 dwelling units per acre.
Trish, could you go back to that?
Sure.
One for a minute, and if you could just show us where the middle school is said to be sited and the elementary school.
The middle school. The elementary school is being constructed right up here.
Okay.
And I believe the they've been working on this plan. I think they're now looking at a middle school site down here and administrative offices more up in that location.
To replace Lincoln Center?
Possibly. I don't know exactly.
Okay.
I think that's part that's been a discussion, but it could be another kind of administrative facility too. Certainly. Oh, this is a little bit light. I hope you can. It's the gradations here are essentially this map is illustrating distance from. We had this map as a paper map at the community forum, the second one. So this is a 1 mile. The palest color here illustrates 1 mile from a kind of a major shopping location, Chapel Hill North here, Carborough Plaza here, and then this these areas down here are in relation to, you know, downtown Carborough, Chapel Hill. So we've got the all of the locations that are in this palest beige color are sites within 1 mile of a 1 mile radius of a shopping location. The purple illustrates 2 miles, and then the green is 3 miles. And so the exterior, the farthest most line is up here in this area. And so these areas, these portions of the northern study area fall outside of a 3 mile distance to these shopping locations.
And that's just by radius. It's not necessarily by being able to drive or to walk.
No, that is right. It's not a driving.
Topography.
It doesn't take into consideration those kinds of constraints. It's just really as the crow flies. So we have, very briefly, community input was provided at these forums. There were also citizens who did come to some of the meetings and offer their, you know, offer information to the NSPIRC members throughout the year. At the first forum, there was a process of asking for specific comments in response to questions. What is working, what's not working in the northern study area and in the implementation of the plan. And so there were 127 comments, different comments that were offered to folks, 12 that were working, 105 that were considered not working. The comments were categorized by the committee into these categories. And with the, you know, the highest number of comments occurring in the transportation and transit and land use categories. In the second forum, there was also a commenting period, but it was very much focused on, well, there were two kind of input components to that second forum. And the first was this commenting and working on a mapping exercise where folks talked very specifically. And so the comments are about specific locations where they might like to see things done differently. And there were maps provided and acetate templates of walking distances and also example types of development that folks could use to tape down onto maps and sort of, you know, envision how this area might develop differently. And there was also a visual preference survey that was developed by the committee, and it had I can't tell you the number of photographs. I have many photographs illustrating both building types and land development form. And each participant was asked to fill out one of these surveys and provided that information back, and the committee then subsequently reviewed it and took it into consideration in the rest of their work. y'all have also requested some maps showing walking proximity of the specific tracks noted in the NSPIRC recommendations, to see a small lab proposal that was developed by one of the committee members, and then to understand, I guess, the arterial buffer and small lot possibilities a little bit further. So we've got we've got maps to show this information for you, and hopefully that will help look at these points. The three areas that are specified in the first recommendation from the NSPIRC are this area up here described as property that the Zinn family is looking at for development that they've purchased. They've purchased several tracts up in this location. It totals about 27 acres, I think. And the center of it falls just about in that spot. So these are 5-minute and 10-minute walking circles. They're about quarter of a mile and then half mile from the center of those sites. Again, they're just as crow flies kinds of things. The other location, the next location is the Hogan Ayers property here, which is adjacent to the Twin Creeks property and also adjacent to the Fox Meadow development subdivision. So the center of the site is just about in this location with 5 and 10 minute walking circles. You can see the number of rooftops that are captured within these walking circles. And then finally,
does part of Duke Forest fall within that red circle up there, or just within the gray?
Within this one?
No, the Hogan Ayers.
I think this is a piece of Duke Forest right here. So yes, there's a little corner of it right down there.
Okay.
In it. That green line, it does. That green line right there is our jurisdictional boundary. So it's just inside that quarter mile walking radius. And then finally, the Hogan property. There are a couple of lots down here on Homestead Road, the center of which is just about in this spot. And then so we're looking at 5 minutes and 10 minutes again from those locations. I apologize for the lightness of this. We were trying to make sure it was transparent enough so you could see what was underneath. And that's definitely succeeded. But there are blue buffers along this roadway, basically, that are about 90 feet. We could turn the light down, actually. You might be able to see it a little bit better. And we can do that if you want to look at this, examine this one more closely. We made 90-foot deep buffers on this map. So there are 900 feet deep buffers on these arterial roads in the northern study area. So Old Fayetteville Road, Old NC 86, Hillsboro, Estes, Old NC 86 up here, Homestead, Rogers, and then Eubanks in this location. So we only made these buffers within the northern study area, within our planning jurisdiction. We didn't put them, in the town boundary over here or outside of our jurisdiction up here. So it just shows, you can see it probably most clearly over here on Rogers Road, which lots are captured within that 900 feet and which ones are not. But I apologize that it's very light. Say, the small lot case study piece is an example that was provided by James Carnahan for the committee in illustrating a portion of his rezoning proposal that was presented, again, in the process of the committee's work. And the idea was the opportunity for sort of rezoning along arterial roads in town, looking at smaller in this area and also in town, but looking at small lots as development or redevelopment sites, much smaller than the 50-acre minimum that's currently provided for the village mixed use. So this is about a 9-acre tract right here on Homestead Road, just east of Calvander. And the proposal for the site is here. This was also included in your packets, and James is here tonight and can certainly, I'm sure, describe his thinking behind preparing this plan. But it does include retail and office at the front of the site, residential here, parking that would be shared for these uses, open space back here, a commons space in this location, and I think perhaps community gardens and a number of other community and environmental features or things he included in this plan. So transition to part two. I'll pull it up. And
could you go back to
sure.
That walking distance map for a moment?
Yes.
I just want to look at it because it went by kind of quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I have another question about that middle circle, mm-hmm. the Hoganeers one. So what is the, is there current road access coming to that center area? Or is there?
Well, there, the Tally Ho Trail, the main,
that's where
talks
that,
about
that
it, stubs out there.
Okay.
And the road that's coming in from into Ballantyne, sort of its main road, is proposed to stub out in this location. And that's the road that's to be shared as the access road to Twin Creeks Park. Then coming up from the south, the Lake Hogan Farms connector road is going to come through Legacy at Hogan Farms and then come up through Ballantyne. And the current version of the plan for the Twin Creeks Park sees that road, you know, going off to the east and then coming back through the school sites, or okay. alongside the school sites and up to Eubanks.
Thank you.
Sure.
As Lisa's coming forward, let me tell you a couple things about her. Lisa is our newest planning staff member. She has an undergraduate degree in Spanish and history from Notre Dame. She has a master's in regional planning from UNC and a master's in environmental management from Duke. She's a former middle school teacher. She also worked at the Southern Environmental Law Center, and she came to us most recently from Clarion Associates. So, Lisa,
thank
take
you.
It away.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you.
Thank you. I am told some of you are very familiar with form-based codes, and others of you are interested in kind of an overview, so hopefully this can be interactive and informative for all of us. Just an overview, I'll give you a brief definition, tell you a little bit about how the form-based code process might be implemented, and I'll talk about two case studies in North Carolina. So there, believe it or not, there's actually a Form-Based Codes Institute, a group of architects, engineers, planners, et cetera, and this is how they define, this would be the official definition of form-based codes. Regulation, of course, it's a legal regulating document, and it's meant to achieve a specific urban form. It's very prescriptive at times, it's how it's labeled, and predictive. I like this definition. I read it in one of the papers that we distributed to you all. It's a tool to implement a physical plan of a community. It's one of many tools that might achieve a certain prescriptive physical form, and it also comes from an existing plan, a regulating document. And so some of the regulations might address these following features: the form and mass of buildings, the scale and types of streets and blocks. They may talk about alleyways. They may limit the size of blocks. And finally, the relationship between building facades or building materials and the public realm. So they may prescribe public spaces. They may prescribe the types of materials and the types of windows that you may use, the location of primary entrances, for instance. And I took these pictures from the new form-based code in the city of Belmont to give you an example of how these codes are very well illustrated and use a lot of photography.
This is Belmont, North Carolina?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Down east.
Mm-hmm. So just to describe it a little bit more, usually the form-based codes begin with, like many planning exercises, a community visioning process. We want to understand what is this form that the community desires. What's the height of the building? What ought the buildings to be made of? What is the character that we're trying to convey? Importantly, they're linked to specific locations on a regulating plan. They might be town-wide. They might be neighborhood-specific. They might relate to a certain transect or tier or scale of uses. They're highly illustrated. They might have photographs or SketchUp drawings or diagrams. And I like this feature. They tell you what can be built, and often the development community, the public, elected officials like to see, okay, instead of telling me what I can't build here, what can I build here? There are many characteristics of a form-based code, but these are some of the common ones. The two are the building forms themselves, and also the architectural standards. They might be combined as one, but the first three are the primary features, and the administration might be in another section of the zoning ordinance or land use document. There are optional features, including signage standards, environmental resource standards, landscaping. I saw some codes where those are rolled into your building form and architectural standards as well. There are many different ways to implement this. A local government commission in California standardized 6 main steps for preparing a form-based code. The first is to determine what conditions are actually on the ground, the topography, the natural features, but also the built environment. To have the public visioning and charrette process early on in the planning process. And then 3, to determine the appropriate level of application. Again, is it by neighborhood? Is it townwide? Is it specific to certain undeveloped tracts of land? Later on, you'll develop your standards. You'll develop your building, your urban standards for parking and street width. You'll develop your actual building forms and building types, and then you'll illustrate them. So on to the case studies. The first I'll tell you a little bit about is Belmont. And I learned this information by talking with staff there and then also looking at their form-based code. They're a small city. They've been growing steadily but not rapidly over the past 10 or 15 years. They're actually the first in the country to adopt a form-based code, which I found pretty interesting. And they intended to do so because they wanted to maintain their historic downtown character in newly developing areas. So they decided to apply these regulations throughout the jurisdiction and adopted them in the mid-90s, and then a few years ago decided to refine them just a little bit to meet their changing development needs. And briefly, Marty asked me about the review process. They use a conditional use permit for their largest developments of 30,000 to 50,000 square feet.
And what was the impetus for the refinement?
I believe they found them to be, like some communities, they were a little bit too prescriptive, they were a little bit too detailed, and while they didn't, they wanted to be a little bit more careful in their development review process, and they actually decided to cut down and condense the regulations, give a little bit more authority to the staff. So just to look a little bit more closely what exactly is in a form-based code, it's a standalone chapter in part, and it specifies different building types. Here there are 8 of them, 4 residential and 4 non-residential building types. They also have regulations, general regulations for all buildings. And these are some examples of non-residential shopfront buildings in Belmont. I just like that term, and I also like the various forms that it takes on, from a corner building to a grocery store, which is the second picture, and to a mixed-use building in the third one.
These are buildings in Belmont?
They are.
And did these all go up since the code was adopted?
Some of them are redevelopment. The third one was an established structure that they redeveloped or refurbished. And the middle one, I believe, was a different type of use, and now is a grocery store. But the first one was a new building. Okay. I wanted to show you just a little bit more closely how it looks, how it's highly illustrated, as well as concise. You can see the illustrations right here. I'll just make that a little bit bigger for you. And it has all the information that you might expect in a zoning ordinance, but it's concise. There are some quantitative standards, pictures,
It looks just like the stuff you got there.
And then further standards that specify generally some general requirements as well as materials, the configuration of buildings, and finally the techniques of buildings, of building construction. There we go. Okay. Technically, all of these codes are considered hybrids because they have use provisions. So they're not just telling you this is what we want the building to look like, but to some degree, they're also still maintaining their permitted uses. And I'm going to give you an example of this up close, Chapter 5. This is their district provisions. They have just about a dozen districts in this community of 9,000. They have seven sort of neat categories of use. And then you scroll down a little bit and you see what building types are permitted where. So it's a pretty elegant style of creating their use regulations and merging them with their building forms. Okay. My next example is not far from Belmont. It's Huntersville, which is also outside of Charlotte. They're quite fast-growing. They were only a community of several thousand when they adopted the form-based code in the mid-90s, and now they have over 40,000 people. The planners weren't shy about telling me that they, in part, adopted this to curb growth just to a small extent or just to make sure that it wasn't going at such a rapid pace. They wanted to encourage density. They wanted to encourage a pleasing and attractive urban design because they wanted to attract some transit up from Charlotte. They adopted this shortly after Belmont did. They also applied it to all new development in their jurisdiction. And you might be familiar with Birkdale Village, that this code was used in reviewing Birkdale Village and also Rosedale, which is a redevelopment site. Birkdale looks a lot, I would say. I would compare it to Meadowmont. It's a little bit higher and has a little bit more higher-end retail, but the urban form and the materials look very similar. This is a snapshot of their code. Again, you can see it's highly illustrated, also has photographs. It was prepared by a different consulting team, so it has a different kind of look. But generally speaking, they're very similar. They have regulations for architectural standards. They're telling you what can and where the parking should be located on the lot and what the lot build-out ought to look like. And then, of course, there are dimensional regulations for height and uses. These aren't, of course, the only communities in North Carolina. Knightdale recently adopted a form-based code a few years back. In Mooresville, which is also near the Charlotte area, rapidly growing, and they recently rewrote their zoning ordinance and adopted a form-based component of that as well. Some of the things I learned in this process, the communities adopted the form-based code for different reasons in many cases. Sometimes they got similar products because they had a similar vision, but they all had different development conditions, and yet they were adopted them for different reasons. In many cases, the market forces, of course, influenced what actually ended up being built. Just quickly, there's an example of the form-based code in Arlington County, Virginia, which was adopted about 5 or 6 years ago, and they found that it was hard to attract the development that they wanted because all these regulations slowed the development process. Related to that, there is a lot of commitment of resources before and after you adopt these new regulations. There's a learning curve to understanding them. There's a learning curve to implementing them. In some cases, in Huntersville, for instance, they had to hire a few more staff people. But then again, they were building and growing, so perhaps that was another reason why they added to their staff as well. And then in many cases, staff as well as consultants helped prepare the code. It was a joint effort. And again, as I told you with Belmont, they adopted it, and then almost 10 years later, they decided to make some refinements and adjustments when it wasn't performing exactly as they wanted it to. So to bring this back to the Northern Study Area, these were some of the recommendations that we gleaned, and I believe there are 12 or 13 recommendations that the committee made, and I've listed here them on the left. There's some overlaps between them, and I thought that we would start off the discussion to see, just to kind of get your reaction to some of them related to form-based code, some of them not related to form-based code. The staff spent a lot of time thinking about how to present this information simply because there is some overlap. For example, in the third recommendation, revise the existing village mixed-use ordinance, that might achieve the result of creating form-based regulations. It might go far enough. It might not go far enough. So these are all interrelated. Secondly, under enhancing protection of streams and buffers, one recommendation the committee made was to, below that, require compact development footprints. So those also could be achieved by consolidating or condensing some of those. So there's lots to discuss, certainly starting with this table, but also branching out from that. So thank you for your time.
Actually, I have some questions. Is Huntersville the town that has the inclusionary zoning?
I'm not sure.
Davidson.
Okay, never mind. And I guess my next question, with regards to both Belmont and Huntersville, is there anything in their codes or form-based that addresses affordability of housing, both rental and for purchase?
I can't say for sure. They may or may not. I don't know. I don't know that that would be affected by the form-based code, except that they might have certain, again, descriptions or regulations related to the appearance of that. But I didn't see that in the form-based code piece.
Okay. I might want some information, unless the board objects to that, while we continue this discussion, since it's going to go on for quite a considerable amount of time, whether or not, I mean, not just tonight.
Not
but,
tonight.
Right. But in terms of whether Belmont or Huntersville have any ordinances that either encourage or discourage affordable housing, both rental and for purchase.
We'll have to look into that.
Jack?
Each of these recommendations and the material, thank you. That was a really good presentation.
And thank you.
Glad to have you here. Thanks. Let's hope you still want to be here by the end of tonight. Each of these recommendations has with it a fair amount of material that we received, some fairly lengthy discussion, and seven, if not more, points of view regarding the recommendations. So I'm just wondering how we're going to go about tackling this. I think the very first one is a huge discussion. I find
what is the very first one?
Target and rezone specific tracts of land on east side of Old 86.
Yeah.
And then the whether or not to have form-based, the streamlining, the permitting process, the mechanisms to allow smaller scale, which in one case, one of the mechanisms was a recommendation for seven stories. So much for, never mind. Anyway, each one of these is quite a discussion, so I don't know how we're gonna dig into this.
My question is, along similar lines, Mark, because, in February we set up a schedule that staff was going to come back to us over a period of time so we would have staggered discussions of these different items. Mm-hmm. And then we decided to have this work session. And what I'm not clear about is if we have specific goals for tonight's discussion.
because what, like, I agree with Jackie that what's up there is extremely broad and wide open and, you know, could take an awful long time if we think we're going to talk through all of those or even a few of them tonight. And I guess, the board maybe the board members who asked for this work session, or maybe you, Mark, have something in mind in terms of what we want to get out of this specifically tonight, and we could use that as sort of a guide to how to proceed.
Well, I have something in mind. I think the first idea is to ask ourselves, what do we want at the end of the day in terms of what we want to happen to the Northern Transition Area? What are our goals as a board? And how do we get to those goals? The reason why I asked for the work session was is because I thought, you know, this is my opinion, not everybody else's opinion, but I thought we had a fairly shallow discussion about something that's really important that will affect Carver after people are throwing dirt on our coffins. So, in light of that, I think we needed to have a presentation like this to get the information out to both ourselves and to the public. And so I think the next question is, what do you want to prioritize first? What do you want to discuss first? And key on that. Whatever the majority of the board wants to do, let's focus on that. If it's to codify the protection of the lands within the Upper Bowling Creek Conservation Area, then let's talk about how that's going to be done. Because, you know, the plan is integral. Once you decide where you want to protect, that means there's only a certain amount of area that's going to be developed. Then the question is, what do you want to be on that particular part of that particular land? Period. Do you want more commercial? Do you want more liquor stores? And I'm using that as an example. Not to say that I'm for more liquor stores, but really that's what we're getting at. How we get there, you know, I think some of the zoning that we have now is form-based. You can only have certain things at certain places and certain sizes. That is a type of form-based zone. We just don't call it that. When you have R20, that means you can have a big, huge house if you want, and that's what happens. That's what we've seen. If we're going to continue to do what we're doing now, we're going to have more suburbia and less walkability. We know that for a fact. So the question is, what do you want to prioritize first? And then go say to staff, this is what we're going to prioritize for the month of, not to interfere with the budget, for this month. This is what we're going to talk about next month. We tell the public. We would like your input.
Mm-hmm. But we already did that prioritization in February, so are you wanting to change it or just talk about it some more? And what's up there reflects the priority
then
that we did, and we also had an initial time frame that we discussed in February in terms of what would come back. I think we said by September, if I'm recalling correctly.
Then that's what we should do. I think these are ideas for us to think about while we're thinking about what we want to do with those priorities.
Yeah, if I could address Dan's question to some degree. I don't actually recall, frankly, what the exactly how we decided to have this work session, but I think, what I feel like I just saw was a really good, except that I've been embroiled in the committee meetings for the last year, but it would otherwise be, for me, a good introduction to kind of the conversation that the committee, a lot of the conversations that the committee had about concepts like form-based zoning and kind of a lot of the background material. Several of the aldermen probably recognize the earlier part of the a lot of the earlier part of the presentation from the public input sessions, because some of y'all were at one or both of the public input sessions. So I'm not sure what conclusion we should draw tonight from all of that necessarily, but I think I find it helpful to kind of refresh on what the background or the context of the committee's recommendations were. If it inspires, I think it's a legitimate question whether it might inspire any sort of change in direction in how we structured it the other night in terms of which items we're going to tackle first and which items will be come a little later on in terms of what we're going to deal with. Was the staff looking for any kind of specific outcomes out of this conversation today?
Well, I think part of what we were looking for is if there's anything different than what you all said you wanted as priorities in February. And again, this was a work session that you all had requested. It was not one that we had originally suggested.
Right.
So,
okay.
So it's really what you all want it to be.
So it's what Joel, in some ways it is, you're saying you think of it the same way that Joel was describing, and I was describing to some degree, or some mix of that. let me let Randy go, and then
Joel said two things that the last time we talked I thought would be valuable for us to pick up in our staggered conversation, and I don't know whether tonight is where we'd want to start with this. We do have a prioritized list, but one of the things that we haven't discussed as a board is, what are the areas we want to protect, and what are the areas that we feel would be most appropriate for development. I know what the recommendations say, but I haven't heard discussion amongst us, as far as that goes. And I think that may be the same conversation in terms of we'd agree exactly with what was recommended, or we might raise some other questions, but I think our concept of what should be protected, we need to kind of knock that around and then maybe look at how we see development and where.
Would that be items 6 through 9 then on the prioritized list?
What page is the prioritized list?
It's page 2 and 3.
Page 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Would that be 6 through 9?
Under environment and greenways. Is protection of lands.
Is that the kind of protected that you're talking about?
Compact developments under number 9.
Well, I think, Jim Rabinowitz said this the last time, and I think he was really on the mark when he said, it's all about the environment. I think when we talk protection, I'd rather not look at the priority list and have that dictate how we talk about protection.
Well,
it includes that, but I don't want it to be limited to it.
Wait a minute. You're talking page 2 and 3?
Yeah, that's the prioritized list.
That's our prioritized list, or that's
the recommended
committees.
No, we've talked about some of these.
This is ours.
At the last meeting, some prioritization of these.
Right.
Not necessarily to say we were going to do all these,
right.
But in terms of which ones
these
we were
the ones that we pulled
but
out.
The
order of discussion, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Jackie.
I kind of feel that when you're getting ready to do something, the first thing you have to do is make sure that you have all of your tools that you need, and that the tools are in working order, and that everybody has the same tools. It seems like for the task in front of us, for our tools, we would first need to talk about the existing VMU ordinance, and do we want to change that? And if so, do we agree with the revisions? And then we would need, if we decided, okay, we're going to keep it or we're going to tweak it, then we would need to go on to the permitting process, the next to the bottom one, and do we or do we not, if we're making these changes to the VMU, want to have form-based code, and if so, what would that look like? And once we get those two pieces, those two questions answered, then the other things, including create mechanisms to allow smaller scale, yes or no, to require compact footprints, yes or no, those sort of things will be easier to deal with. If that makes sense, or that could just be how my mind organizes things.
Yeah, I think the reason we need to, or a reason we need to talk about specific zoning first is that there are property owners out there who want to have some idea of what's in store for their future. So even if we're revising VMU or streamlining whatever, that they should have a notion that that's what's coming. And I think
so
that's part of why it made sense to put that first. One thing I wanted to raise, two things, is possibly fruitful for discussion. When we set up this process, whenever it was, 15 months ago or so, you know, one of the parameters we put into our resolution creating NASA Park and all that was that we would maintain the overall density through this process. And that's something that I don't see actually came out in terms of the recommendations, and I think it's something, you know, that we need to decide that when, you know, when we said that, did we mean it and do we still mean it? And that is in line with the point that Mark made a month or two ago when we were discussing this before about whether increasing density in some areas should involve a reduction of density in other places so we maintain that overall balance. And I think that also ties in to the discussion I raised at our meeting 2 weeks ago and also at the Assembly of Government about tying our zoning to a sense of where we want to be over time relative to our water supply. And I think we need to draw that into the discussion. So I'd like to talk more about that. The other thing that I think would be fruitful for us to hear tonight and maybe talk about a little, since this idea of the form-based zone is out there, I think we ought to know from staff what it would take to create that zone. You know, how much time, how much cost if we're going to hire consultants. I mean, obviously we're not going to get firm numbers tonight, but, you know, are we talking about a two-year process? Are we talking about $50,000? And, you know, how does that, and that will give us some sense of, is this something we want to jump into this coming fiscal year, or is it something, you know, maybe we're not ready to do?
Or even to gauge if there's an interest in pursuing form-based zoning.
Well, I'm going to ask you just a clarifying question. Uh-huh. When you talk about overall density, uh-huh. are you talking about just residential density, or are you talking about commercial density? Because to me, it's two different things.
But right. The stipulation in that resolution was in regard to residential density.
I just want to
figure out what the number was.
I just want to make sure.
Right.
Yeah. And I agree with you, the implication of your question that we can increase commercial density without increasing residential density necessarily, and that would be a good thing.
I guess I would want to have more discussion if we're going to discuss that. What effect does that have if we limit the amount of residential density? What effect does that have on the affordability issue? Because we're getting we are real unaffordable now. Just let's put it out there. And that's a big concern I have. And I'm not so willing to approve in the future any large suburban subdivisions. I'm just speaking myself personally. That don't have a larger component of both walkability and affordability within them. Because what we're getting now is neither that much walkability or it's what I call shallow walkability. You can walk in your neighborhood, that's all right, which is good. But, you know, the idea of affordability in that part of the town, if we don't talk about it and talk about what we mean by compact and what we're going to protect and what we're not going to protect, then we're just going to be unaffordable, period. And we need to just say we're going to be unaffordable and not waste that time when people run for re-election talking about I'm for affordable housing.
Yeah, no, I agree with both those goals, absolutely, Joel. I guess what I would clarify from my own perspective is I don't think that how much we build will give us affordability. It's how we build and the kinds of systems we create around the housing that we're trying to establish as affordable and sustain as affordable.
I agree with you there, but I do think size has some relation to affordability, and also size has some direct relation to the amount of water that is used. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just
size
a fact. Size of dwelling
unit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a fact.
It's OASIS proved it.
Lead us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we move on to the next agenda?
Yeah, sure. So we're done, right? I want to throw out a couple of thoughts at y'all before we depart the subject for sure, which is I'm very interested in this concept of form-based zoning, and I think a lot of I think it has a lot of potential to help create the kind of physical landscape that I would like to see Carrboro grow into, you know, in the areas where we're growing to grow into. And I think that part makes a lot of sense. I have some reservations about the notion of a some type of purely form-based zone, because, and let's be clear about what the opposite of form-based zone is a use-based zoning system, in which you real focus not so much on what the building is going to look like, but what activity is going to go on inside and around the building. And the reason I mention that is I think our hearing the other night actually illustrated this issue very well. Nobody really had an issue with the building that they wanted to build over at Roberson Square. Is that what it's called? But there were issues about what was going to go on inside the building. Were they going to have a restaurant or not? And were the parking requirements actually going to be able to be met? And I imagine that towns like Belmont and so forth have some way in which their system is not purely form-based. It's not purely looking at what physical shape and layout the building is, but also gets to the use issues to some degree. But I just want to put that out there, that when you think about parking regulations, the use of the building is very essential to figuring out what kind of parking requirements you would have, for example.
For commercial.
Well, and also when you think about compatibility, you know, there are some things that you don't really want right in the middle of a residential neighborhood.
We all love the cat's cradle, but
no matter what,
nobody lives right next door to it.
Right, exactly.
No, but that came up on the Center Street discussion last week about, well, you know, do we want a use in that building mm-hmm. that's going to have late night bands mm-hmm. or...
There you go. So somehow, I just want to lay it out there that there's, for all the criticism that use-based zoning gets in these various articles that were submitted as a part of this packet, that there's still a lot of virtues to use-based zoning, and I don't want to lose sight of what's good in that system mm-hmm. as we discuss the notion of form-based zoning. The other thing I wanted to point out is have any or all of you had a chance to stop by what was formerly known as Johnny's Sporting Goods on West Main Street at all recently?
Yeah, they're always out of cinnamon rolls,
yeah.
Which is a good thing.
Well, it depends.
It's now just called Johnny's, I think, but you know, it's a really neat business, and I'll probably hear some complaints since I mentioned it tonight, but I haven't heard any complaints yet about the changes that have been going on over there. I've heard nothing but positive feedback. I think people who are within walking distance of Johnny's are very excited mm-hmm. about the new commercial services right. that are available there, about having a destination that they can walk to, and that there's a lot of, I guess my point is just that there's a lot of good things about what's going on over at Johnny's. And I think that, you know, if through the process we're going through, we made it possible for there to be at least a few more places, and I'm not talking about big places, I'm talking about things maybe right at the scale of what they're doing at Johnny's, if that became possible for more of Carrboro's neighborhoods to walk to a facility like that, if a Johnny's or two cropped up on Hillsborough Road or on Homestead Road or Rogers Road or Eubanks Road, that seems like it would be a good thing to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It so happens, I'll point out, that I believe there's an apartment in the a residential apartment in the upstairs of that building that Johnny's is in. So it actually happens to be a mixed-use development, a very old one that predates any of our zoning, I think, in Carrboro. But it's a good example of how that kind of thing can actually be a mixed use. But I think the fact that it happens to have a residential component to it is entirely incidental to the matter. That's not why anybody likes it except the person who happens to probably live in the apartment. And so part of what I'm trying to get to is one of the things that we debated in the committee was about the notion of potentially very small mixed-use developments. And Carnahan's example of a, what I would call kind of medium-sized mixed-use development was put up there for a property on Hempstead Road. But I'll just point out that, you know, you could take that down to an even much smaller scale than that, and down to the scale of the half acre that Johnny's happens to be located on. And I think the one thing that struck me between what's happened at Johnny's and the presentation tonight is, well, I don't know why it has to be mixed. I mean, I don't know why we have to talk about it being a mixed use. I mean, the fact is that at some level, one of the things that we, I think the whole board would like to see is some increase in our commercial tax base. The residential component could be, in a particularly in a very small on very small lots, entirely absent, and that would not necessarily be a problem. So I just want to throw that out there as something maybe somhat additional or slightly
in a way you could think about it as, like, you know, if you think about James' example that was up there before, where it was, however, I guess, 100 some odd residential units and this much commercial. Well, if you've already got that X percentage of residential out there, as you do on Main Street there, and you get that one lot where you can put a commercial building, you know, then you're sort of achieving the same thing without having to call that commercial building itself mixed use. I agree with you 100%. I think Johnny's is a great model. But on your comment about the mixed use versus the form base versus the Euclidean zoning, I think we're also seeing that we have a mix of that, particularly in our downtown, you know, because mm-hmm. of the standards that we've created around that. Even though we never thought we're doing form based zoning, a lot of that is in there, both through the process we've gone through in adopting our land use ordinance for downtown and how the zoning applies there. So we've kind of come at it the other way and gotten to a lot of that same result. And, you know, I had asked Steve this question. I don't know if you all got around to this in your meeting yesterday about whether it's possible to avoid that big process of creating a form and let apply that charrette process to specific developments as they come in and bring in the neighbors and bring in the community and have the developer be required to work through something that then creates those forms for that specific development that's going to fit with the fabric that's already there and with the goals of the community. And I was thinking of that in terms of a way to both jumpstart the thing and eliminate the cost and the time lag of developing the kind of big zoning revision that are implied in these Belmont examples and otherwise.
Well, I think the VMU, in my opinion, is a hybrid of form-based zoning.
Right.
Because it's not completely Euclidean,
mm-hmm.
and it's not completely form-based either.
That's right.
I'm just trying to summarize this in my head and make sense of it. What's next, or how we can eat this elephant? Some people say the way you eat an elephant is one bite at a time. This is basically, refresh my memory if I'm wrong, part two of the small area plan, right? I mean, there was conversations that predates me, but there has been discussions about, I mean, conservation had always been the forefront of this government. Right. And what has been always floating or has not been fully explored was the expansion of some commercial development.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the issues that are, I guess, tying our hands or preventing us from achieving I mean, I'm all for expanding the commercial tax base. And I think that's the last frontier, or the last one of the last opportunities we have in Carborough to achieve that goal. Is to, do we need then to look at the VMU ordinance in order to expand commercial density? Is that something that is hindering us from us to explore tackling the expanding the commercial tax base?
Well, I think, you know, that if I can dare to answer that question on behalf of the committee, I think our feeling on the committee was that the problem was not how much commercial is allowed in a village, in the current village mixed use rules, but more that a VMU type of development had to be at a minimum of 50 acres. The plan didn't call for any specific location where a VMU type development would happen. And essentially that really almost the only way that any type of commercial development would realistically happen in Northern Carborough would be if and only if it was a part of a village mixed-use development, part of a VMU. So I think a lot of what these recommendations get at is trying to move away from requirements that it must be part of a 50-acre development, that it must be that when you do a VMU development, you don't necessarily have to include, I think in the current rules, your village mixed use under the current rules doesn't have to have any commercial component. you can bring and in fact, the fact is that when Winmore was approved, the board was not necessarily thinking about these issues in exactly the same way at the time, but as it happens, the way the Winmore was approved, they were not absolutely required to build the commercial component of Winmore at all. Now, I think they are doing it, contrary to some people's claims.
We'll know when we see it.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. We'll see when it's built. So the point is that the problem with VMU as far as getting us commercial development is much more fundamental than just the question of how much commercial is allowed as a part of VMU.
Well, let me just add also, the present Northern Transition Zoning was a compromise because the majority of the then existing Orange County Board of Commissioners did not want that much commercial out there. And right. Thus, we were also limited by the office assembly zoning requirement as well as the limit on the amount of commercial.
Right.
The office assembly is where we really got our nose cut off. And then when the county zoned for the park out there, it took one of the best areas that we had for this. And so that kind of throws us back to where we are now, that what we were hoping could happen can't really happen anymore. So we need to look for other ways.
It is worth remembering in all of this that I think most or all of the changes that we're proposing for areas north of Homestead Road a good portion of the area involved. We need for it to also be approved at some point by the county commissioners.
I think you got a different. My opinion is I think this is the time, given the county's economic situation and the pressures brought on by the addition of schools and other what I call human resource issues that the county has to pay for. Everybody's got to step up and really look at economic development and at least say, if we're going to have it and if we want it to be locally based, it's got to go somewhere.
Right. Well, I'm not trying to guess what the county will or won't go along with, but just be aware, bear in mind that at some level the county government's got to like it.
Mark, I wanted to ask, going back to Winmore, Winmore had small commercial, but it did, you know, block in some commercial. And the size of the commercial that I remember Winmore initially, conveying as being a little market area, you know, about the kind of thumbnail that we're really talking about in some of these other areas, you know, if we took small infill spaces. And, you know, although I think that, you know, depending upon what it is, it could be very successful out there, I'm kind of concerned that the recommendations only had three areas for commercial. Is that the extent of it? Are we really only talking about the Hogan Air, the Hogan Track on Homestead, and the area that the Zins have north of Eubanks? Are those the only three?
Well, no, I don't think that's not how I read the committee's recommendation. Now, that was one of the subjects that the committee was kind of divided over, but it's not that's you know, it says specifically those three are mentioned in these recommendations, but then it goes on to say somewhere else, and I couldn't point to it right now, but basically this idea that at some level the major transportation corridors through the area, Old 86 and Eubanks and Rogers and Homestead would be eligible for some of these smaller VMU type developments. And I think, you know, there was some real contention on the committee about that idea. But
see, that's the thing that I think is important to, rather than just putting all the eggs in one basket and looking at A, B, and C, how do we create code that allows for the potential along the major arteries to have something get converted in the way Johnny's has gotten converted and infilled? That's what that's what I'm seeking, because I really am excited about the prospect of something being in Winmore. I don't think it's going to address, 500 houses in everything north of Homestead. So I'd like to see the potential for something like a Johnny's come in on an infill. But what kind of code do we have that would allow for that in that perimeter of arterial roads?
Well, let me say about, I mean, I don't know, but is part of the answer. But I think one of the points one of the reasons that subject was contentious on the committee was that the way that it seemed at the time that concept was very broadly worded, and I think in the recommendations it is maybe still in there and quite broadly worded. I guess the point I would get at is this: is Johnny's is on Main Street there, and it's a little island by itself. It's not that's happening to every house or every other house all up and down Main Street. And I'm not too a little bit more of it might be nice. A lot more of it might be obnoxious, and that was the concern. Was that some of us on the committee, myself included, had, was that the way it was being talked about made it sound to us like the idea was, just a wholesale redevelopment of these major transportation corridors and conversion to mixed use and so forth. But there's a lot of different ways that you could do it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It could be, one end of the spectrum is a wholesale, rezoning that says, hey, if your property fronts on anywhere on Hillsborough or Old 86, then here's a huge new range of things you're allowed to do with your property. Another approach is to say, gosh, we think a reasonable walking distance to that type of function is half a mile, so that if these little nodes are spaced 1 mile apart along the corridor, then no matter where you are on the corridor, you should be about half a mile from this type of mm-hmm. service. That would be very different and much more, mm-hmm. There would be much more limited kind of approach to that.
don't know if I want to limit it that much.
Well, I was trying to give a spectrum.
Right, and
give a spectrum of
right.
approach.
And I'm not thinking of you know a series of you know individual you know a string of individual shops either. But I'm thinking, you know, if a space that's conducive to it, for example, the classic on 86 in Dairyland, you know, Reagan's spot, you know,
Reagan's garage there.
Garage, yeah. That would have become available, that would be an appropriate spot. Whereas, you know, you have, you know, housing developments, you know, along Homestead that if you, for example, the Hogan Air property is kind of landlocked. That, to me, is not going to be, I mean, regardless of the fact that you can get to it off of Ballantyne and you could potentially get to it through Fox Meadow and you could potentially get to it through some road that may or may not be built. I know Greenway has talked about between Lake Hogan Farms and the schools. But that piece, to me, is not really a viable place unless you, you know, create a very different kind of scenario, which could happen. But
it depends on what they propose.
You would presumably not have, for example, a grocery store right there. It wouldn't happen.
Right.
Because the road access then is onto basically Lake Hogan Farm Connector, which
exactly.
is going to be all
right.
four-way
exactly.
stops. And
but I think one thing is clear from the travel map.
I'm not promising that it'll be for all four-way stops. So let me be clear about
yeah.
that. Okay,
but one thing is clear from the travel map that Trish had shown in distances. You know, when folks are traveling 3 miles or more, or 2 miles or more to get to a grocery store, then they're making what probably would be unnecessary trips for one or two things. And so if there was some kind of small space for some grocery, maybe, you know, along Homestead, that would be very reasonable. The question is, does it only come down to these three properties? And what I'm trying to get a feel for is how do we create opportunities for it to maybe be elsewhere other than just targeting these three or only looking at these three as the ones that are most viable.
Well, you think they're going to put a grocery store in Eubanks when they smell the landfill? We need to be realistic about what is actually there and what we need. Because there may be some small office commercial something that could be put there. So, you don't know, to say that we're going to be stuck with residential, knowing that residential drinks up a lot more water than commercial.
And
school space. Mm-hmm. We know that.
Mm-hmm. So, I think this proves my original point that there's much to be said on each of these items, and how do we go about...
Well, I mean, I think the answer is we've got mapped out before us actually a process for going through them. We're spending a few minutes here kind of exploring some of this a little bit,
yeah.
trying to do it. And it's such a congenial conversation so far that I'm kind of indulging it. But Lydia?
Yeah, I just wanted to pipe in with a few thoughts I had about the way the discussion's been going. And in particular, I wanted to echo Randy's points. And I mentioned this during the last meeting also, that while I'm interested in these three spots, these three tracks that are identified, like Randy, whether it's form-based code or whatever, I'd like to see us figure out a way to allow some sort of commercial, small commercial, light commercial, opportunity for commercial to happen in the rest of the northern study area. And also that I think it was Joel's recommendation that we all get all the minutes from all the meetings from all the last year. And I attended a good many of those meetings. In fact, I was listed absent twice, and I wasn't on the committee. But anyway, it, right.
That's what happens when you show up.
I guess
that's
so. Right. I guess so. But honestly, it was a good review of just, you know, how hard this is and how much all of these volunteers struggled with this and worked with this all those months. And you know, all the people on the committee were, of course, as you know, interested members, but you know, many of them lived in this area. And overwhelmingly, the theme throughout all of those meetings was, let's figure out a way to have more commercial opportunities and have walkability in this area. So I think that if you haven't had a chance to thoroughly look at those, it just kind of provides an overview of the struggles that committee went through. And I think we're going to continue to go through them in our meetings here in these upcoming weeks and months.
Mr. Mayor, could I just make a comment, just as someone who's probably going to at some point get involved in the drafting of this? I think what would be the most useful for the board is to not get hung up or involved in the question of how to achieve the objectives. But if this board could reach consensus and get a direction on what you want to see, then there's, I mean, the form-based zoning is just a tool. I mean, as several of you pointed out, all zoning regulates use, and it all, including those zoning ordinances, and they regulate building and site design. Those are the two things that they do. They all do it. Some do it more, are heavy oriented to the use. Some are more into the design. I mean, we've done both here in Carrboro, as has been pointed out several times. In some of the more recent ordinances, you've struggled mightily with getting architectural details worked out for both sub-residential subdivisions and business, downtown businesses. That was quite a struggle. To get that prescriptive in these types of codes would involve multiply that by about 10 in terms of the time involved, and that's what you're talking about, in order to try to get advanced prescription of that kind of of architectural details like they've done on those codes. But they're all in there. It's just a question of – those are all techniques. What I think the staff needs to get direction on is what you want to see. So if you, for example, say we want to see – we want to what we'd like to see is both corridors lined with businesses, not residences. There's ways to achieve that. If you say we want to make it available so that, like you said, Mayor, you know, every half mile there's a business, we can do that. If you say we want all big boxes in three different locations out there, we can do that. The difficulty is not the technique so much as getting uh-huh. direction on what you want to see. If you want to see the intersections around, you know, 86 and Calvander in that area, you think that's the place and you would like to give, you want to provide the opportunity and to preclude residential and make sure that gets developed in a commercial fashion, then if you make that decision, we can come back to you, I think, with here's the technique to do that, or here's alternative techniques to do that and to control the architecture and whatever you want to do. But until you, if you get hung up or involved in discussions of, you know, what technique or what ordinance do we want to use to get there, until you've decided what you're trying to do, it's going to be a hopeless discussion. I mean, because everybody will be coming at it from different places. If you just tell us this is what we want to achieve, even starting with one thing or whatever it is, whether it's starting with a commercial, this is what we want to see and where, or then go to residential or whatever, however you want to do it. But if you do it in that fashion, if you tell us what you want and are clear, give us clear direction, we can come back to you and say this is the way to do it. Here's this technique, or here's that technique. And there's different ways that we can get there. But we can't begin to suggest those techniques to you until you really say this is what we want to do.
Okay. That's a great point. John, and then maybe we can move on to the next agenda item.
Yeah, and that's – I was going to say the – in commercial development is something that we all want. Can we, I don't know, test the board, see what kind? Nobody wants big box development there, right?
I don't know. I wouldn't mind.
No Target. I know you want a Target.
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 That's cool.
But, I mean, the people, and feel free to jump in, you guys who participated in a lot of these meetings, what do the residents in that area want? I mean, I hear coffee shops. I hear kind of small, medium-sized commercial development that.
Well, I think there was interest. There was interest in that type of thing, you know, coffee shop type of thing. But I think there was also, I would say, I mean, grocery store was actually something that came up frequently in the discussion. I wouldn't say everybody was in favor of grocery store, but there was definitely interest in that type of function, drugstore.
Right, and you do realize just some facts that I did this afternoon because I was home with a sick child, that Lydia lives the furthest away from a grocery store in Carrboro. If she decided to walk to the grocery store, she'd have to start
from
a Carrboro
grocery store, not to a Carrboro Capitol grocery store. North.
The closest grocery store to her is at Chapel Hill North.
Is it Chapel Hill North? But she's still 5 miles away.
Well,
5.9.
Bear in mind that you know there's obviously with any of these stores. I mean, grocery store is a great example, but with any of them, there's a sort of practical reality they've got a lot of criteria about where they want to be in relation to other grocery stores and so forth and so on. So they have their own ways of making decisions about what are acceptable locations or not. Same thing is true with Costco or anybody like that. In fact, a representative from Costco, you know, has directly said to me that no place in Carrboro basically would meet their criteria for locating. For example,
let the average income continue to grow. They'll be sitting up here with something that they want to put in. Wait on them longer than they can
but
wait.
I tell you what it gets down to, though. Really, I hear you on that, and it's fair enough to say, but they want to be on 15501.
Yeah. They want rooftops.
And 15501 doesn't come through Colorado.
Nope.
I think
that suits me, but I'm just saying that's, you know, so there's some economic realities to any of that, too. But anyway.
I think we also need to respect the decisions that have been made by people like Lydia who've chosen to live many miles from a grocery store.
Well, I don't know if she really made that choice. That might not have been the decisive reason. I don't think we should cross-examine her now.
But the reality is we have homes going in out there. You know,
right.
We need to kind of be forward-thinking and figure out how it's going to grow, you know, both commercially and residentially.
And, you know, gas continues to grow.
You know, this presents a really interesting opportunity of what people want as a grocery store. And what we've been talking about in some ways is a local livability standard. It might give us an opportunity to do something really creative, like encourage and help people to develop a grocery co-op or something along those lines, or a locally owned grocery store that had locally owned products in it, not exclusively, but generally.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So if we're looking to do our local livability and then we're looking to develop commercial areas, let's not have those discussions in separate meetings. Let's find a way to bring them together.
Well, stop by the front store at Johnny's, tienda at Johnny's, an incredible little grocery store right there that's entirely locally owned, but learn about local goods. But anyway, all right. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating.
So are we going to, the next time we talk about this, talk about the VMU and whether we want any modification for commercial?
Well, is that the time? Is that the next? Well, I mean, what was in our, what did we decide in our resolution would be next?
It's the order that's up there in the packet.
Well, let's do that order then.
Well, we could do the top three.
Uh-huh.
Well, the top three.
Top four. That's fine.
Yeah, I think that's
a good start.
Okay.
This has been a good kind of.
Is there anything else with that we need from staff before the next time? Mark, is there anything else from staff that we would want to direct staff to have ready for us for?
Yeah.
Okay, so what the list that's up here is the list that was the reorganized list from your first review of the recommendations. So,
right.
And but you what you the order you adopted was takes
page two.
Does pull 10 and possibly 11 up into that.
What are 10 and 11?
10 and 11
small scale
form based, and the 11 was looking at streamlining the VMU by using a form-based. And the reason we had pulled that up to begin with was because, you know, it might be that in the course of revisiting them, a form-based process might have been the way to go without it becoming a bigger, more elaborate process. That's why we pulled that in there as possibly elaborate.
Well, it seems to me that gets at some level to what the attorney was talking about earlier, which is Well, those might be useful tools for doing the first four things on the framework list a moment ago, but why don't we decide on the what and then get our attorney to advise us on the how a little bit later on.
If you get hung up on deciding what how you want to modify the VMU district before you've got consensus on whether you even want commercial in there, now you're going to spend all time talking about the technique with no consensus on what the objective is.
Right.
Recall that that ordinance was a product of a specific objective that had been decided. In other words, there was consensus and an agreement on a plan that said this is what we want, and then that ordinance was drafted to effectuate what was desired. If you want to start tinkering with the ordinance before you decide where you're trying to go with it, it's going to be awfully difficult to accomplish that.
Right. Yeah, so I think, I mean, I'm not going to rule out anybody bringing something up that amounts to something from 10 or 11, but I think we want to focus on the first four things.
I just wanted to know how what you want to do with Resolution 116 then, just by make that very clear that we're, this is whatever you do, if you're picking the first four, that we're replacing this and it's not, they're not, we're not trying to do them in parallel. That was the only kind of point of
clarification. I think we're essentially by consensus here modifying our earlier resolution.
Right. Sorry to interrupt.
Trish, just wanted to be clear.
No, it's good that you asked that specifically.
Trish, the first
make sure you get that in there.
The first item, you know, about the three specific tracks.
Yes.
And I remember the committee kind of honing in early on and as those three tracks as kind of pretty big undeveloped commercial or undeveloped property, I guess, that they identified. Do I remember an early map that kind of showed the tracks in the northern area that were possible for consideration for commercial beyond just these three, or that were not developed just beyond these three?
Well, the map that we showed that has all of the sparsely developed properties, you know, that information is available. And then we did do a report a couple of years ago on commercial opportunities in the northern study area, which did include a couple of other properties on old NC86, both on the east and the west side, and then another property on Homestead Road.
That's sparsely, the one with the sparsely populated tracts, can that be emailed to us or sent to us?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Or let's have it. Why don't you make sure it's in the agenda packet for whenever your next. When are we next
either,
discussing?
Either
this?
Or both is we can.
Well,
I mean,
both
we could
is
post
fine,
it on the web, for this item, just as an additional piece of information with these materials.
And go ahead and email it to us too.
Okay. I'm not sure we want to drop number 10 from this list because. And we've had a lot of discussion this evening.
What does it say again?
It's create mechanisms to allow smaller scale mixed use projects.
Because,
I mean, we've all been talking about wanting that to happen
as
a priority.
What that says is create a how to allow the
base form.
You know,
I think that will come into the conversation about what we want.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, I don't think anybody's in disagreement that they don't want that. That's one of the things that we want. I hear a consensus.
Right.
The question is, where is it going to be allowed?
Well, maybe we need to modify number four, which is examine tract size minimum and add, to that with the goal of allowing smaller scale mixed use, blah,
blah,
blah.
Well, that'll
work.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine.
Combine them.
So that way we're clear that we want to get at that,
right.
That part of the discussion.
You got that, Drew?
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Agenda item 2.
Well, now that we have that solved.
Actually, before we go into agenda item 2, let me just say I want to point out that the staff person who primarily deals with this is Sarah Williamson, and Sarah, it had been the plan that she would be here tonight. She was not feeling well, and so she was unable to join us. So I just point out that, to some extent, some of what we're going to talk about has to do with her job and so forth. So I hope that we'll kind of, if we come up with something, kind of refer it to staff so that we can get her reaction at a later date before we make a final decision. Mm-hmm. Or we could just discuss this on another night. It's another possibility.
We could wait until Sarah's here.
We could wait because 32 minutes of the women's championship game has been going on. I'm not saying that's a reason to adjourn, but
if we might, can we not wait till our next work session since we've already put it off a couple of works and, like, do it?
Well, just
do we have time for next week to talk about this, Steve?
Can I tell you that we'll try to do that? I know we've got
at least one big item, and that's the parking report back from the MP, the
well,
master
let's
students.
Say this. Let's say this. We'll do it before our next work session. We'll work it into one of the next couple.
Yeah, and we may be able to do it next week. I need to look at what else is on there. I think we have a couple of other maybe big items.
All right. With that understanding, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second. Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes.